What I Believe was the title of two separate essays by the philosopher Bertrand Russell and the novelist E.M. Forster in the early 20th century. These two humanist activists set out their approach to life, their fundamental worldview, in a way that was accessible to all. I'm Andrew Copson, Chief Exec of Humanists UK, and in this podcast I'm talking to humanists today about what they believe, to understand more about the values, convictions and opinions they live by.
Hello there. I'm Alice Roberts. I'm Vice President of Humanists UK, and you've found your way to this fantastic humanist podcast. So I'm thinking you might be interested in finding out a little bit more about Humanists UK, which is the national charity working on behalf of non-religious people to advance free thinking, to combat discrimination against non-religious people, and also promote generally a fairer, more tolerant society. If you'd like to support the podcast or find out more about the humanist approach to life and all the work of Humanists UK, please visit the website. It's easy to find if you just search for humanists.uk. If you like what you see there, please consider joining us as a member. I'll let you get back to the podcast.
Tommy Shepherd is the Scottish National Party MP for Edinburgh East and has been an MP since 2015. He's the current SNP spokesperson for Scotland. As co-chair of the All-Party Parliamentary Humanist Group, he's a fierce campaigner for humanist values inside and outside Parliament. In July this year, he secured a debate about the presence of the 26 unelected bishops in the House of Lords with cross-party support. Tommy, thank you for joining us on What I Believe.
Pleasure.
You're a politician, so I think the most obvious questions to start with is why? What was it that took you into politics? Must be some values and beliefs that have propelled you into that line of life.
Yeah, I guess quite sure when I would track it from, but probably from about the age of 14, I began to get annoyed and concerned about the world around me and what was happening. I mean, I should say I was brought up in a Protestant garrison town in the north of Ireland during the Troubles, so it was a bespoke environment. So I was concerned, obviously, about that situation. But I also became concerned. I joined Friends of the Earth in 1975. So at that time I was very much concerned with the anti-nuclear campaign, right, the campaign against wind scale expansion and stuff like that. And that got me involved with a number of different organizations where I began to develop an alternative worldview. And I suppose it's from that sort of 14, 15-year-old that I began to develop my general outlook in life, which I would sort of call a left social democrat type of approach. I very much believe that we are social beings and that we, as a species, we achieve a lot more if we work together, and that we are on a very, sometimes seems like a slow and lengthy journey towards our fulfillment. But one day it will come when we will, learn not to kill each other and to work together for the benefit of the species and, of course, for the planet.
You see that fulfillment as being a group achievement when it comes?
Yeah, I mean, I don't decry the role that individuals can make, but I think it's a collective endeavour, both between people within nations and between nations. And I think it's, one of the reasons why I'm a passionate advocate for Scottish independence is not because I'm a nationalist, but it's because I want the political agency that comes with that in what would be a small Northern European country, to be able to determine the way in which we can work with other countries to achieve a lot more. And I think Scotland could punch above its weight in that sort of environment in a way which it can't, as being constrained really as a sort of sub-region of a much larger, much more conservative neighbour to the south.
So, I'm sure we'll come back.
We can get into that, yes. So yes, very much a sort of socialist origins, I suppose, and that's odd in a sense because my family. I mean, my father. I'm from a working class background. My father was a painter and decorator. My mother was a school dinner lady and then a cleaner. So, you know, I'm from a manual working class background. And my father, I do remember, in my father had been a supporter of a thing called the Northern Ireland Labour Party back in the 1960s, which was a sort of ill-fated attempt to bring together Protestant and Catholic communities on a behind a, you know, well, like a Labour type platform. But it, I mean, that broke down when the trouble started and things were divided on sectarian lines. I mean, and there are still attempts to this day to build such non-partisan things in Northern Ireland, although my focus has shifted well away from that, being resident here for many more years than I was resident there.
But were you about to say that you thought that your parents and your background had played a role in shaping those early values?
Well, certainly my background did, because I mean, you know, I experienced inequality firsthand, and I was we had the 11 plus there, you know, so I passed my 11 plus and went to the local grammar school, and probably for the first time came among posh people, and I was friendly with one of these guys, and I remember going back to his house after school one day and just thinking, wow, this is like a mansion compared to where we live. and it began, you know, the unequal nature of what people had in that community soon became quite apparent to me. And I thought from a very early age that was dreadfully unfair and we should do
something about it. Why did you think that?
Something about it.
Why did it feel unfair, do you think?
I thought it was unfair because I was in the receiving end of it,
right.
For one thing. But I mean, I do wonder if I'd been the middle class kid with the big house, would I have felt the same way? I hope so, because I think these things are more innate. Really, they're not all determined by material experience. Although I am a materialist philosophically, I do believe that, you know, that our material environment does condition and a lot of our thinking, but I'd like to think that, you know, you can see and witness the inequality without having to experience the inequality, and it's the seeing of it, the manifestation of it, that would lead you to say you don't like this. It doesn't seem fair. I'm not saying everybody should be paid the same. Of course, people do different things and have different levels of responsibility, and that we ought to have a reward system in society which recognizes that. But I think a society where the lowest paid worker gets, you know, 100 times less than the highest paid worker is pretty uncivil, to be honest. And I would want to see a much narrower range of incomes.
So you made a distinction between your background and your parents. Is it, are you saying that actually these weren't your parents' values as such, or in spite of their background?
Oh, no, well, I was saying, so my old man did have, I mean, I remember dad's dead now. We were fishing out the papers. I found some old trade union cards, for example. So he had a bit of he had some knowledge and awareness of that. And he did probably from a primary school age. I mean, he'd say things looking back on it, which might have help provoke these attitudes in me. You know, he was aware of the unequal nature of society and was quite concerned about it. My mother was less engaged, less animated about any of this. But I came and then when I was 18, I left Northern Ireland, went to Aberdeen University, and I had already been involved in environmental campaigns and various discussion groups and stuff. And when I got to university, I just, like, suddenly from coming from this repressive, conservative, small town environment into, you know, Freshers Week, where you had a stall with every one of the 57 varieties of the left on display and slogans everywhere and campaigns everywhere.
In Aberdeen,
yeah, in 77. And I just, I was seduced by the whole thing. I just went overboard. And, I was in all sorts of campaigns. And, I mean, the anti-nuclear campaign, still pretty major to me. But, I mean, I joined the broad left and stuff. I stood and got on the student union council as a first-year rep. And, You know, and I really began to get sort of more engaged and then to think about, you know, what I would join. It took me 2 years, actually, to join the Labour Party. I didn't join any party until I was about 20. And I did so after a sort of, you know, just tasting all of the other varieties that were on offer and deciding that I wanted to join the Labour Party. And the reason, to be honest, was that I had a very clear view by then of the type of society I'd like to see. But in order to get there, you needed a mechanism that allowed people to work together and to achieve that. And I was the other component of my belief, I suppose. I was always very much about change by consent. And I do believe that for a society to work, people have to actually buy into it.
So you are a Democrat. The democratic part of the Social Democrat is important to you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, and you can't, I think if you try and impose change, I mean, I can see some people with the best of intentions trying to impose progressive change in an autocratic sense. It usually fails because unless you have people with you and wanting that to happen, then not only will you not actually achieve the change, but it won't be sustainable. So I've always thought that you need a mass party of reform. And when I looked around, the only game in town in the late 70s in Scotland was the Labour Party. So, and that's saying something. That's the winter of discontent and Jim Callaghan and all the rest of it. Right. So, I mean, this wasn't very progressive, but it struck me it was the only political structure which had the potential to achieve the type of social and economic change I wanted to see.
That's pragmatism then, as well as democratic support.
I wouldn't call it pragmatic. I'd call it a rational and logical examination of the alternatives. And
do you think pragmatic is a negative thing?
Well, I think pragmatic implies that you're doing something you wouldn't necessarily do if circumstances were different.
Okay.
And I don't think that's the case. I mean, it was a clear, I thought this was the body that had the most potential to achieve the change that I wanted to see. And although the type of change I want to see has not changed in the last 40 years, obviously my mechanism for getting there has changed, and we can talk about that if you like.
We will talk about that in due course. I want to go back to the nuclear, anti-nuclear campaigning, though, because it's not something that anyone else has raised, although we've had people of your age and background do the podcast as well. What was the climate in which you sort of formed this as a priority? What were your sort of concerns and the outlook that made you think, well, this is the issue?
Well, I mean, I think, I don't know if you remember Harrisburg, the nuclear plant in the US in 77, I think.
Around then, but...
Well, it had a near meltdown. I mean, it had a partial meltdown, and it was a big radioactive release and stuff. And it was a little bit, it was like an American Chernobyl, only on a slightly smaller scale. It led to a film called The China Syndrome, which was quite a famous, popular hit Hollywood movie at the time. That and the Windscale development and debate about radioactive waste, I think you could see, I mean, we didn't call ourselves green or concerned about climate in those days. It was very much an ecological, environmental type concern. But that was, I think it was in the mid to late 70s, is it? We really went through the gears in terms of the importance of environmental issues in UK politics. And I like to think I was a first responder in that, and actually the ideas I was arguing for then were on the edge. They were fringe ideas, but they've now become mainstream. I mean, they're now generally accepted. Of course, the nuclear weapons was coming up in the rails as an issue as well, and that accelerated after Thatcher's election in 79, of course. And by the early 80s, CND was, we were having mass rallies, 100,000 people plus against nuclear weapons. And there was I remember sharing a house with, I bought my first house in 1984 in London with two others. And Colette, one of my co-owners, she became pregnant and had a kid. And I remember having a serious discussion at the time about whether that kid was going to see adulthood because of the state of the world. I mean, people were genuinely fearful, I think, that, you know, nuclear annihilation. I mean, because the arms race was in full swing. You had Reagan going nuts, and people were genuinely very, very frightened, and that fear motivated people to action, I think, and saw some of the big demonstrations. So that was hard to describe if you weren't part of it. The feverish nature of that of those times.
So this was a motivation really for human survival. It felt total human survival, human civilization, the continued existence of humans. Yeah. Really.
I think the other ingredient in me is I have always been very much an iconoclast. I mean, I don't take no for an answer really, and I don't accept things. I don't take things at face value, and I'm only gonna argue for something if I believe in it, sort of thing. So I've always asked difficult questions, and actually, it was my primary school headmaster, Mr. Preston, who told me that. He said, never take no for an answer, and always ask questions. So whether it be the teacher in front of me or the monarch on the realm, I've never accepted authority without it being justified to me.
And was that something that your education encouraged, your secondary education? I mean, you spoke about how being sort of like kicked up into a sort of middle-class education,
yeah,
was something that made you realise the unfairness and gave you a greater thirst for justice and equity. But did it also do some, it must have done other things for you, such an education as well?
Yes, but perversely it didn't intend to, but it did. because I was the kid in school who, like, probably every Friday for every week of the term would be in detention because I wasn't wearing the regulation uniform, or I'd worn it too long, or I'd done something. My war of attrition against the authorities was happening even then, and I was paying the price for it. And that, yeah. So the school gave me lots to protest against as well. The rules and regulations that were there.
Today, you're one of Britain's most prominent Republicans. I'm going to carry on the theme here of iconoclastic tendencies and resistance to authority and so on. Republicanism is of course a growing opinion amongst society. We had a recent poll that showed it's a growing opinion, particularly amongst the young. But it's still a minority opinion. In fact, what was it? What is it that you see in it? Is it? Well, you tell me.
Well, I mean, I think the idea that the head of state should be the preserve for all time of just one family in the country is the notion of that is an affront against every democratic value I have. I just think in a civilized society, people have a right to appoint and to hold to account their leaders. And everyone should have the opportunity to put themselves forward for that. And the idea of a feudal monarchy completely contradicts that. So I'm never going to be at ease with it, no matter how ceremonial people say it is. It has real power, it has real authority, it has real legitimacy in the eyes of the public, and that ought to be something that's subject to democratic scrutiny and involvement. And
so it is a democratic point. It's not about the stark unfairness. It's about our political constitution.
Absolutely on constitutional grounds. I am in a minority, but you know, I think I'm moving towards being part of the silent majority. And I mean, there is an awful lot of. I mean, okay, we don't have. It's not like Russia or China, or whatever. But I mean, there is a. It's very hard sometimes to speak out on the question of the monarchy. A lot of people feel very uneasy about it. They'll get shot down in flames, and they'll get ridiculed, and you know, belittled. It's not easy to do. It's a very controversial subject, and it really ought not to be. And a lot of people, you know. There's so much heat around it. A lot of people just prefer to keep their heads down, even though they don't believe in it, but they just think it's not worth having the fight over. But somebody's got to raise the issues.
Do you enjoy being iconoclastic?
Yeah. Well, I enjoy it more than being subservient.
Good. Let's come on to nationalism. It's interesting that you say that you're not a nationalist. I think I'd like to unpack that a bit more, obviously, because, mm-hmm. well, for obvious reasons, being part of a campaign for, how can I put it, for nationhood, for the country that you're living in now. How do you square that off then? Because most people would diagnose nationalism if they were faced with an argument for a country to separate off from a bigger country and become its own nation state. I mean, it's textbook nationalism as far as, you know, Bertrand Russell would have been concerned from the Baltic examples onwards. But that's not your motivation.
That's not, no. Okay, look, I mean, in the sense that I am advocating that Scotland should become an independent nation state, then you could say that is a nationalist perspective. What I mean when I say I'm not a nationalist is I don't say that there's anything particular about the people that live in Scotland that make them better than anyone else. I don't even say that they have a common purpose necessarily. There are many different types of people with different interests who live in Scotland. What I'm saying is that in this very complicated, terrifying world at times, for people to have agency, they need to be able to come together in geographical units, which we call nation states, and to use what power they have collectively to try and influence things. And at the moment, the people that live in Scotland have relatively little ability to be able to do that. And our ability to influence the world around us and to control our own very considerable resources and to ensure that they are regarded as a common treasury for all rather than being something that is mobilized by global corporations. All of that depends upon, in my view, having the democratic ability to control things here. And that means that we ought to be a self-governing state. Now, I want us to become that, not in order to put boundaries between ourselves and other parts of Britain or Europe or the world, but to actually build bridges with them, to give us the capacity and the agency to engage with other countries, to forge international relationships, to be part of the British Isles, to be part of the European Union, to be part of the UN, and to play a much more positive role within that. So for me, creating an independent Scotland is all about opening up the world rather than setting ourselves apart from it. And it's about engagement rather than separation. So that's what I mean when I say I'm not a nationalist. And the other thing to say is that I only want this ability so that we can resolve differences of opinion or conflicts within our society here. Mm-hmm. And I come back to the notion I have of a much fairer, more equal, more collectivist democratic society. Well, I told you 40 years ago I thought the Labour Party was the vehicle to achieve that. I now believe that it's more likely that that could be achieved through having the political agency to do this in Scotland, which is why I'm arguing on behalf of the SNP for Scotland to become a self-governing country. And basically, I got quite solid in this view about 15 years ago, and it was as a result of basically asking myself the question, which is the more likely and plausible route to achieving the type of society I want to see? That we have the capacity to make these changes in a small country where probably a majority of the population are predisposed to the arguments I'm making, or to stay as 8% of a much larger political union where there appears to be an inbuilt majority against the type of arguments I'm making. And for me, it was a bit of a no-brainer.
So it's another example of you believing that this is a rational route to a better world, essentially.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, and the alternative to not being a nationalist, and that's, I mean, because the people that argue against my position, they're not arguing there shouldn't be nations. They're just saying Scotland should be part of a different nation, okay? And in truth, you know, the only people who aren't really, I mean, you'd have to be like a Leninist, and by which I mean John rather than Vladimir, and think that, you know, imagine there are no countries. I mean, it's only in that sort of utopian sense that you can imagine there not being nation states. And I actually don't think anybody seriously engaged in this debate at the minute is putting that forward as a point of view. So they're not saying the SNP are wrong because they're advocating that people in Scotland should be members of a nation state. They're just saying it shouldn't be our own nation state.
do you believe in nation states in general? I mean, you know, okay, so if it were possible, just out of interest, I mean, if it were possible for the ultimate aim to be not having them?
So I don't, I mean, I'm very, very resistant to any notion of there being sort of ethnic or biological characteristics within certain groups of people that give them something in common that gives them political agency. I'm very, very hostile to the idea of society being organized along ethnic, racial, or even religious lines, to be honest. But I think the idea of having a platform where people can come together, resolve differences, and act as a collective unity is very important. And we're not, and I also think that in the current context of globalization and the growth of private corporations and the power that they have, that it's more important than ever that democratic nation states exist and sort of renew themselves, if you like, renew their legitimacy with their public and engage their citizens, because without that, we're going to be powerless to deal with many of the changes that we're faced with, some of which are existential in nature.
And it sounds like you really believe that politics and citizenship are the ways in which to have that conversation and achieve that change.
Well, yeah, yes. I mean, I think how else would one?
Well, some people believe. But yeah, that's a good question. But nonetheless, some people do have other views. I mean, there is the example of those who, from Elon Musk outwards, who think that the best way to secure a brighter future is through, you know, maybe a bit less democracy and some more strong men states that can command and control. I mean, welcome to it.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are 8 billion people on the planet now, it's important that we try and find a way in which those 8 billion people can be the custodians of their own destiny, really.
And if they were all citizens of democratic societies, you think it would be more likely that we'd have a better future?
Of course. And I do think we're moving in that direction. You know, compared to 100 years ago, we have many, many more, we have many more states, we have many more democracies, we have much more in political and civic engagement amongst the world's population than we have probably ever had before. There are some blips along the way, and sometimes you go 2 steps forward and 1 step back, of course. But the general progress of humanity is in one direction, and I'm quite hopeful for it at the end of the day.
Collective endeavour, humans as social beings, social democracy, iconoclasm, asking difficult questions, and rational routes to a better world. Tommy, thank you for telling us what you believe.
You're welcome. Thank you.
What I Believe is a weekly podcast from Humanist UK. We'll be releasing new episodes every Thursday. If you'd like to support the podcast, find out more about humanism, Humanist UK, and the work that we do, you can find out more on the Humanist UK website, humanists.uk. And if you like what you see, please consider signing up as a member or a supporter. You can also find out more about humanism by purchasing the Sunday Times bestseller, The Little Book of Humanism, available at all good bookshops.